say, for example, Sarah cut me off in traffic. Traffic's a big issue for me. But say Sarah cuts me off in traffic, it doesn't faze me. It's not an issue for me. Then God's not going to judge her because she hasn't hurt anybody. But if I react and think, oh, she cut me off, and you know, how could she do that? Then God has to kind of view that as a sin, like to a certain extent. Like He has to acknowledge that she's hurt somebody. That's one interpretation of the concept of love covers a multitude of sin.
Well, in our imperfect, selfish, evil ways, wouldn't we want God to see it as a sin because we want justice?
Sin isn't something that we decide. Sin is something that God's decided. So whether we view it as a sin or not doesn't change the fact that it is or isn't. It's just that she's hurt me. And that's what God has to recognize. One interpretation.
What if you're just like an oversensitive that gets annoyed at like anything?
In terms of,
like, will God then consider what you, like, if someone else has upset you? But in reality, it was just something that's, you know, quite blase. God still going to punish that person that has upset you? Or, like,
I'll just wait until she's
finished. Like, is that person that upset you, are they still going to be judged for a sin because they have upset you?
It could also be kept, like, I'll take your traffic example because traffic's an issue for me too. It could also be like, you know, if you're driving in traffic and somebody annoys you for something, and you kind of go like that. and it's obvious, because that happens to me every damn time. You get cranky and it's obvious. You could also, that's a bad thing. Because you kind of lose your peace at that moment, and you might say some rusty little heads up here. But you can also cause that other person to sin as well. And that's, I think, really important, because what you do doesn't, you know, the whole issue of what I do only affects me. No, what you do can have ripple effects on other people. And you could cause that other person to sin. So by hating someone, you could cause them to hate you or the wife.
If the person's intentions are pure and it's not, there was no issue and I'm really sensitive, then God's not going to, as far as I can say, like, God's not going to condemn you or judge you for that if your intentions are good and so forth. But in terms of when, say, you genuinely do something that might hurt me and I don't even think about it, then, you know, God is grateful to that it's not an issue, you know, like, and He would bless that relationship.
Like, He'll be grateful, but that doesn't, if the other person's knowingly committed something and you just haven't reacted, they've still committed a sin. They've still done wrong.
But if God sees that you showed them mercy,
He's showing that you didn't sin.
But, like, if they, I'm happy for you or anyone to jump in. But I think, like, if God sees a relationship of love, for example, okay, so say I did something to you, I gossiped about you and that wasn't very nice, and then you found out about it, but you thought you made nothing of it and you moved beyond that, then yes, God will judge me for that sin. If I don't return to Him and apologize and repent, the same as we've always understood. But I still think that if He sees you show me mercy and that I move beyond that sin and I do better, that He will bless that too.
I think it's a really
cool
moment, just that I'm responsible for my own actions, and that's really independent of what the reaction of the person in front of me is. So if the person in front of me is a very nice person, accepting person, whatever it is that I do, that doesn't give me the license to just do whatever I want because this person's going to forgive me. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, it would be nice if everybody was very forgiving. Unfortunately, that's not really the case. So I should just The best thing is just to worry about yourself. Don't worry too much about the reactions of the other person and what implications, you know, of that reaction is going to be on whether or not how God views my sin. Worry about myself, okay? And just make sure that I do everything that I can not to offend somebody, not to upset somebody. And Nadine's issue of somebody who's hypersensitive. I must go the extra mile, take a second step, take a few do a few extra things with that person who seems to be sensitive that I might not take with other people. If I'm worried about the reaction of the other person, I'm going to get lost. I'm going to get preoccupied, and something that I can't control anyway. Worry about myself, okay? And so, basically, you know, I don't be the person who provokes a reaction, and then you won't have to worry about what their reaction is. Try not to be the person who provokes that reaction.
Sorry, that was not my thing. Yeah.
Don't push your chair any further back.
Oh. Yeah. Thank you. Oh. Okay, a passage in 1 John, I didn't want to read it, it's a bit long, but the heading on of it is that love allows you to know God. You know God through love, okay? So the verse is that nobody has seen God. So we know that God is love, but nobody has seen God, and so to know God is to love Him and to be always in the act of love, and through that you know God because He is love. So we might not have Him physically here, we might not see Him, but I know that God is love, and if I practice love and accept His love, then I know God. And so there's no space in that for me to have enemies. You know, the minute I have an enemy, I'm not participating with God in this act and relationship of love. And I always misunderstood the verse that says, how can you say you love God but you don't love your brother? And I thought, that's possible because my brother can hurt me but God can't. But the point is that because God is love, that if I'm honest about loving God, I can't help but love man, whatever he does to me. Whether he's my enemy or my friend, I can't help but love him because that's a consequence of me understanding that God is love. So we class people as enemies or friends based on our relationships and our circumstances, but again, in God's eyes, we should have no enemy but sin. Okay, so if you find yourself faced with an enemy, and we'll look at different kinds of enemies and so forth, but if you're faced with an enemy, see how you can make them no longer an enemy. You know, and I'm not just talking about being indifferent towards people and keeping your distance. He's saying love them, not just don't hate. He's saying love them. So do things that are classified as love towards them. You know, even the simple act of praying for someone that is giving you a hard time. I mean, and I think that would be the most effective thing to do because that gives it to God, that asks God for His strength and His ability in me to like to help me do that. So in that passage that we just heard, it said, love your enemies. So it classed enemies as those who curse you, those who hate you, those who spitefully use you, and those who persecute you. And we could probably come up with a few more categories in terms of practically day-to-day who we call enemies, but we're going to look at how Christ dealt with each of these types of enemies and see what he did, because he's our ultimate goal. Okay, if we look at individuals, like you all might have like someone in mind who you've kind of classed an enemy or is giving you a hard time. So keep that in mind through this talk. If you're struggling in a relationship or, you know, someone is giving you a hard time, keep that in mind. But we're going to see how Christ dealt with his enemies, and we use the term very loosely. So from Christ's perspective, we're going to look at how St. Peter, in a way cursed, but denied Christ. those who hate you, so the Sadducees and the Pharisees and those who were attacking Christ, interrogating him, and who really didn't like what he stood for. Those who spitefully use you, so we look at Judas and his betrayal, and those who persecute you, so that's Pilate, which I think that's what I want to say. So we'll see how Christ dealt with all of these. And you might have your person in mind or relationship in mind, and you know, but I have this right and I have this feeling about it, and you know, this is why this is a person's an enemy. Christ is the Son of God. So if anybody has any right against an enemy, it's Christ. You know? So if even Christ dealt with these types of people in love, we have no excuse but to do the same. Okay? So each of these has a little video. I'll try not to make them too long. So the first one is those who spitefully use you and those who curse you. So So those who spitefully use you. So Judas's betrayal, I mean, the ultimate enemy in terms of, like, from our perspective, you know, he betrayed Christ, he sold him into the hands of those who eventually crucified him. And so how did Christ deal with him? So Christ knew from the very beginning that Judas was going to betray him, but yet he called him to be his apostle. And he called him not with an ulterior agenda or motive, you know, like, I have to do this to fulfill the will of God. No, he did this to invite him to salvation, and he let Judas make his choice. Christ accepted him knowing what he was going to do to him. So I guess if, say, for example, there's a person who is known to be a bit difficult to get along with and so forth, but has started coming to youth meeting and doesn't really have friends or whatever, and you put yourself out there and you befriend them and you encourage them and so forth. It's a very loose, you know, conversion of the story, but the point is that even when you know that you might be hurt but you're doing the right thing, that you do the right thing no matter what, and you show that love no matter what, and Christ will protect you. So Jesus picks a place that Judas knows. So in Gethsemane, he goes there, Judas knows that he goes to pray there. Christ was not hiding from him. And many times before that, it said that the Pharisees and that they tried to take Jesus to kill him, but he fled and then they couldn't. But at this point, Christ was ready and he knew this was the time and he made it possible. So it just shows that Christ had no fear. You know, he knew what had to happen and he put himself there, he didn't hide from him. So even if doing the right thing and showing love might be a bit scary or might have consequences for you, you need to do that. Just as Christ did it, without fear. And it says that perfect love casts out fear. So if you are engaging in perfect love, if your love is pure and holy, and it puts before you a threat that you don't fear because, you know, God will protect me, you know, even beyond death, you know. Okay, so we'll move on to those who curse you. So Peter's denial. This video's got both Jesus' trial and Peter's denial. So.
You shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Father.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one.
Enough.
him before the procurator of Pontius Pilate. In whose hands lies the final authority for trial and judgment.
So for those who've just come, the topic tonight is love your enemies. And so what we're doing is just looking quickly at a few of Christ's enemies, or people who Christ has to deal with in love. And the first that we looked at was Judas and his betrayal of Christ. And now we're going to look at St. Peter's denial and also the trials of the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and what they did to Christ and how he dealt with them. So those who cursed you. So in Luke's Gospel, after the rooster crows, Christ turns and looks at Peter. So it just poses the question that was Peter looking at Christ at the time of his denial, which is very confronting to have Christ before you at the moment of your sin. But that's the truth about Christ with us, is that he's there when we're close to him and he's there when we're in sin. And so that's how he deals with us as sinners. So I wouldn't call St. Peter an enemy of God, but he did disappoint God. And we're just looking at how Christ dealt with him. And so Christ was there with him the whole time, when he was his apostle and as he went through this denial and so forth. So Christ, in love, was present with him the whole time. So I guess if we translate that into our relationships and loving one another, is that not to give up on people who are maybe being a bit difficult or giving us a hard time, and continuing to love them even through the challenges that they put before us. And another thing is that Christ forgave St. Peter long before he committed the sin. So before this in the Gospel, it says in Matthew, it says, "And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." So this was before St. Peter denies Christ, and yet Christ knows it, and he forgives him for that, and then he gives him the promise that he will be the foundation of his church. So if we can't forgive, like, if Christ can forgive St. Peter, then most certainly we can forgive those who give us a hard time or who we call our enemy. Okay, so the trial. Okay, so the Pharisees were confused. They'd lived and grown up and learnt the Torah and the first five books, and they thought they understood how God was going to come, and their motivations maybe were misplaced and they misunderstood, and their eyes were closed to seeing Christ as the Messiah. And so they interrogated him and essentially handed him over to Pilate. All right, so we'll just read a quote from St. Augustine. And it says, "Someone will say, why didn't he do what he himself commanded? He should not have answered the one who struck him." So about Christ. "He should not have answered the one who struck him, but should have instead turned to him the other cheek. But he actually goes further than this. Didn't he answer truthfully, meekly, and righteously, and at the same time prepare not only his other cheek for him who was going to strike it again, but in fact his whole body to be nailed to the tree?" So when we watch Christ defend himself in the most meek way that he did, maybe someone would think, like St. Augustine suggests, that, you know, Christ should just have stood silently and given the other cheek, but instead he answered them. And he said, he told them the truth, and he said, "I am Christ the Messiah," and they didn't accept that. And in admitting that and in delivering that truth to them, Christ offers himself up to be crucified. So in terms of translating that into relationships that we have, is that there's nothing wrong with defending the truth in God's honour and in God's name. If we do it in love, and if it's done with no, you know, apprehension that I might suffer because of that. Okay, so in my relationships, always being a representative of Christ and being his light on the earth. Okay. All right, the final video we're going to watch, and it's not as long, is when Christ meets Pilate, and it's not even the whole interaction, so it's a short one.
This is the man who thinks so dangerous. This, the man that aspires to be a king.
Jesus of Nazareth. You really have to. It's really. Okay, so the interaction with Pilate is very interesting, and we don't see all of it there, but Pilate doesn't really, in the Gospels as well, they're very, like, gentle with Pilate. They don't really convict him. They don't really say, you know, woe is Pilate, and they kind of give him the benefit of the doubt a bit. They still recognize that he was the one who offered up Christ to be crucified, but they're quite gentle on Pilate. And Pilate hesitates, and he at first doesn't see any wrong in Christ and so forth, but he's kind of in a political position to have to make this decision, and he does it. And Christ says to him, you know, the greatest sin falls on those who brought me to you rather than being on your show. He shows him a bit of mercy. So the way Pilate speaks to Christ there, I mean, is horrific. When you're thinking you're facing the Son of God and he's interrogating him in that way and belittling him and, you know, denying him like that, is, I mean, you watch it and you shudder, because this is God and this is how you speak to him.
Sorry. So in the Passion of the Christ, they depict Pilate in a really different way.
Like I said, the Gospels are a bit gentle. What you should do is read each of the Gospels passages.
little one, just because it's on TV, it doesn't mean it's real. Read the Bible.
All right.
The best way is to go through the Gospels and read each thing. I mean, it won't take you a few minutes, but just they are quite gentle on Pilate, in that he's kind of in a tough position. But at the end of the day, he makes that decision, and that's wrong, you know. And I think Passion of the Christ is a movie that places a lot of negativity and blame, like, on the Jews specifically. And it's a very, negative representation. Like, it's just this, it's quite a harsh representation of events. Not to say that it all didn't happen and so forth, but have you watched this? So you should watch it. Read the Gospels and see. But at the end of the day, Pilate offers up Christ to be crucified, so he's guilty to that extent. Yeah.
Did Jesus answer that question at all?
What is truth? Yes. We'll look it up after if you don't mind. Yeah, sorry. I think he does. Okay, so we're just going to read another quote from St. Augustine, and then we're almost wrapping up. Okay. But still, when the ability is given, surely necessity is imposed. Therefore, although David had received the ability to kill Saul, which we spoke about earlier, he preferred sparing it to striking him. From this, we understand that bad people receive ability for the condemnation of their depraved will, while good people receive ability for trying to be heavy. But basically, from what I understand, is that if you're given the opportunity to do good, then you're also given the strength to fulfill it. So Pilate had the opportunity to do good, he had the strength to do it, and he didn't. But if we're faced with an opportunity to do good, then God will equip us as well with the strength to continue that and to do it, and he'll support you through that. But there's a verse in 1 John chapter 4, verse 12. So if we think of the ultimate act of love, what is that? Yep. So Jesus dying on the cross, okay? But this verse suggests that you can add even more to that love. So this verse says, so no one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love has been perfected in us. So if God's saying his love is perfected in us, that means that even beyond the crucifixion, you can contribute to the extent of God's love. Does that sit in your mind? Like, so no one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God abides in you and his love is perfected in you. So his love, which we see on the cross, is made even more perfect when you show love to one another. So that blows my mind. You know, that in me having the strength to show love to another person, I say I don't even add to Christ's love on the cross, but I participate in that love. That's amazing. So every time I show love to a friend, let alone an enemy, I participate in the love of Christ on the cross. I perfect his love in doing that, and I know him in doing that. So if you struggle in your relationship with God to know him, and you're going through a slump and you don't feel his presence and so forth, show love to one another and you will see God and you will know him. And you, if anything you take from this is that if you show love to one another, you perfect God's love in you. Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
Just saying about the what is truth thing,
it doesn't answer at all. Okay, thank you. And that's it. Anyone else?
Next questions for Pat.
Or just discussion?
No, I was just going to say, I looked it up and it just says, I'll ask what is truth, and then when he said this, he went out against the Jews and said to them, I find no fault in you.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he answered it.
Yeah, okay.
And
that's the pattern of Christ in the Gospel. He only answers questions which are useful. There are many occasions when he was asked the question and he changed the topic. So I remember once, sometimes the Pharisees came to him and said, oh, you know, by whose authority do you do these things? And then, so what did he do? He turned it upside down and said, hang on a second, I'll ask you a question. The baptism of John the Baptist, is it from God or from man? And they said, oh, hang on, if we say from God, then everyone's going to say, well, why didn't you listen to him and to me? But if we say from man, everyone's going to say, well, you know, like you guys are sinners, he's a prophet. So they said, we don't know. So Jesus said, okay, I don't know either, you know. And so that's the pattern. He doesn't answer questions which have sort of, you know, not the best intention. The questions that I'm not going to be.
What is truth? Seems so pretty interesting.
Sorry?
I want to know what truth is.
Yeah, that's looking at the person who asks the question as well. So the person who's asking the question in that context is not asking out of a sincere desire to know what the truth is. He's asking, you know, the wrong intention.
And his mission before that was revealing the truth. Mm. So if you haven't paid attention that whole time, he's not going to come at the last minute and say, well, here's a summary. So,
that's true.
Anyone else?
Good question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Pontius Pilate, he didn't say yes or no, he washed his hands from it. So what wrong did he do?
He still had the authority at the end of the day to give him over to the Jews to do what they wanted to do, because the Jews couldn't, of their own political authority, make that decision. So they had to give him to Pilate so that Pilate would then give him the authority. So washing his hands is just a technicality. At the end of the day, he gave him to the Jews to do what they wanted.
I heard a sermon somewhere that said it was like someone giving a lamb into a den of lions and saying, do what you want. Like, so it's he's pretty much
Yeah, and it was very political.
Yeah.
Like it says later that day, Pilate and Herod spoke, and were friends, and whatever relationships that were or were not possible before were made right through Christ's death. So very political.
Peace with all men.
So, I mean, a silly person is not like, that's the least of our concerns. If we're talking about, you know,
The church fathers say that with the accumulation of virtues you become, like, firstly when someone, like, sorry, when you're not that spiritual and someone wrongs you, you can't forgive them, then you become a bit more spiritual and further in the way you start to forgive. And then after that you turn the other cheek, and then the fourth thing you do, which is when, like, I don't know, the Pope or something, you start to feel bad for that person because they've sinned against you. So when people say, I have a hypersensitive friend that gets upset all the time, if you're truly a Christian, then you'll probably pity them for sinning against you. You won't be angry at them for their wrong.
Yeah. It reminded me of something that there's a quote I think we missed today. It's a quote by C.S. Lewis that says, "Do not waste your time bothering." Waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as we do this, we find one of the great secrets. When you are behaving as if you loved someone, you will presently come to love him. So something Uncle Magdi actually once said is that love isn't an emotion. You don't have to feel fluffy about your every relationship you're in. It's not an emotional thing, this commandment of love your enemies. It's more a state of mind. So if I believe I love each and every one of you, and I'm going to do everything in my power to live that, whether I'm genuinely like feeling the emotion of love, it doesn't really matter, that emotion will come and go. But if I'm acting though as though I love you, then I'm doing my part in terms of loving you, and eventually I'll get those feelings and I'll get those, you know, like you said. So we start at a different point. So think of loving everyone as a state of mind rather than actually feeling that emotion.
So it's in my question, but if you don't hate someone, but you don't love them either, is that...
Well, I touched on it quickly before. God is saying love your enemies. He's not saying be indifferent to them. He's not saying keep your distance and, you know, keep the peace, but, you know, you don't have to love them. He's saying love them. So, I mean, at first it might be for the sake of peace, you might keep your distance as a form of training and so forth, but essentially your goal is to love them and to do what Christ did for them, to be ready to give your life for them. So, if you're not ready to make sacrifices for that person, if you're not ready to, you know, be selfless before them, then you need to work on that, and that's our goal.
So, Anna, you have to love me.
In response to Anna, I was just going to say this quote basically sums it up. You don't need to worry about whether you love them or you don't love them. It basically says just act as if you love them like the whole time, and then eventually you'll come to love them anyway.
Yeah.
So you don't need to worry about whether they're your friend or your enemy. Just act as if they're your friend and then you'll end up loving them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as a response to that... as a response to that, I don't think you can ask anyone, hey, would you rather be hated, loved, or... Sorry, would you rather be hated, or would you rather the person just not care about you? No one will ever say I'd rather they just be apathetic towards you. They'll say I'd rather they hate me. And God says, don't be lukewarm, either love me or hate me. So, don't be apathetic.
Can I just mention something about love, right? So if you consider, like flying or something, love. Listen, be quick, real quick. Something about love. Has anyone here had a sick family member, like someone who's had either an illness or a cancer or something like that? And it's something that's really, really bad, ugly, attacking them, making them feel sick, or like a friend or a friend's family member. do you hate them because they're sick? Is there any, like, do you? Or do you, like, feel like, oh, that's not good. Like, you know, it's bad that they're sick, but I feel sorry for them. I feel for them. I feel for the family. That's what's loving. That's what loving someone who you can't love. Because the point is just because they're angry or they're upset or you think that they've got a broken brain or whatever it is, you can still love them, right? Because all it is a sickness, right? So in all honesty, you can love the unlovable. Because the same in the same way that you can love the sick. It's just sick.
There's hope for us, Ted.
No, there's not. Then there's the completely unlovable.
One more thing as well, sorry, back on the discussion before about whether sort of somebody's reaction to my mistake, whether or not if they have a huge reaction that's a bigger sin, and if they have an intermediate reaction, it's an intermediate sin, and if they have no reaction, then it's no sin. If you think about a good soccer referee, right? Imagine you're watching a soccer game, and a player commits a foul. Okay, there, whenever you guys watch soccer, or girls, like there's three categories of people, right? When a foul is committed against you, the first category is, you know, you just pretend like nothing happened, and you just keep running, and all I want to do is get the ball and score. Okay, like Messi does that, he's a legend, right? The second category is, all right, this guy tripped me, I fell. Okay, most of the players do that. Then the third category is where the guy rolls and screams and cries and carries on, and Ronaldo does that. Okay, and so if I'm watching a game, and then I see the referee, and then the player, Ronaldo cries and screams, and a big foul, I'm shouting, yellow card, red card. And the guy just keeps, Messi keeps running, he says, okay, no foul, play on. Am I going to think this guy's a good referee? I think, no, man, you're an idiot. You're being fooled by these people. Okay? So God, we should hold God to a much, much higher standard. It doesn't matter if the person rolls around or doesn't react or just reacts appropriately. The mistake is the mistake. So I need to make sure that I don't give the person opportunity to carry on. So the mistake is the mistake. I need to make sure that I avoid that completely, regardless of how the person reacts. Does that sort of make sense? Okay, awesome. Is there any other final questions for Kat? Well, let's end up.